This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Customs and Border Protection tells Canadian nurses they can't work in the U.S. on the visas they've had for years.
I've never been told by the border that I need to get a different type of visa.
Then your auto insurance is going up. What's the future of No Fault?
Basically, we don't want any reduction in protection or benefits or coverage, but I do want a reduction in my auto insurance premium.
We'll find out where a Michigan artisan gets his inspiration.
Obviously, I'm a product of my environment here in Detroit, so I've got somewhat of an industrial aesthetic.
And a crime novel set in Detroit.
I think August sees Detroit much as I see Detroit, and that is the best frenemy you'll ever have.
But first, here's a heapin' helpin' of the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Your auto insurance will cost more. The Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association is adding another $10 to its annual fee, coming in now at $170 a year. We'll talk about that and no-fault insurance in Michigan later this hour. But first, Governor Rick Snyder wants the $2.4 billion in mental health Medicaid money to be turned over to private insurance companies to manage. He believes that Medicaid funds will be better spent, more people with behavioral issues and mental illnesses will be better served, mental health would be integrated with physical health under the HMOs, and advocates for people with mental illnesses don't like the idea at all. The Michigan legislature asked for a review and recommendations for pilot programs to make it all happen. A group that's been working for a year with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services just turned in a report that basically says the public agency should continue to work with the mental health providers it has been working with and devise plans for more integration between mental health providers and physical health providers. Pilot programs with the health insurance industry were not recommended. Dominic Pallone is the executive director of the Michigan Association of Health Plans, the insurance industry, and he joins us now to help us sort this out. First, this work group we talked about, the 298 facilitation work group with the state agency, turned in the report. Representatives of the insurance industry, your group, were part of it, but your people left it and presented its own plan to the legislature. Why?
We did, and first of all, thank you for having me on. We have continued to be a part of the 298 facilitation work group, which the legislature directed that the department put on, and at the interim report, at an earlier report, we did release what we entitled a minority report, simply because we felt that our opinions, which were outnumbered by the majority of those on the work group, were not properly being documented in the work group's report itself. We wanted to just highlight to the public and to the legislature the areas of differences of opinion. So when we published our minority report, really that was our goal, just properly documenting where our opinions differed.
So the rest of the group indicates they feel the insurance industry didn't like where things were going, and you picked up your ball, left the game, did an end run around to the legislature. How is that conducive to working out a plan to serve the people with mental illnesses?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I would disagree. We didn't walk out of the room in any way. We did remain at the table. We've been back, obviously, for subsequent meetings. We continued to participate in the 298 work group with all other stakeholders and actually voted for a couple of the recommendations that are in the final report. Because we do believe that some of the recommendations that the work group did decide on, and there was a few that received unanimous support, which we were proud to be supportive of, would indeed help move towards better integration for those on Medicaid, for better integration of their physical and behavioral health benefits. We've always been vocal, both in the work group and out of the work group, talking with the legislature and the public about wanting to do what we can to improve the process. I think everybody agrees that the current status quo is not good enough for the individuals receiving this care, and I think we just all have differences of opinions on how to better improve that care, which is healthy to have those differences of opinions, and we just wanted to make sure that our voice was not muffled because of the makeup of the work group, which was heavily slanted against the HMO industry.
As it stands right now, the Department of Health and Human Services works with 10 prepaid inpatient services. Basically, it's a public system contracting out to its partners. Mental health advocates, such as the director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Michigan, Kevin Fisher, says the health plans, you guys, the insurance industry, want to take over, privatize mental health services against the wishes of the very people who depend on those services and their guardians. Here's what Fisher said in a recent interview with Cynthia Canty.
We need to develop a system that best meets their needs. And again, if the health plans can build a better mousetrap, then produce the mousetrap. But don't say, give me the money now and trust me to produce it later.
Dominic Pallone, where's your better mousetrap?
Well, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to prove it. And that's what we've been asking to do. And I would say we have proved it with a number of other populations that we currently manage. So, you know, I do want to be clear, the system as a whole is still a public system. We certainly recognize that, just as Medicare is still a public system, even though the federal government embraces commercial insurers to provide Medicare Advantage to a majority of seniors throughout the nation and here in our state. We're doing the same thing in Medicaid, and we've done that for 20 years, actually, in our state on the physical health side. We've provided physical health benefits through a contracted arrangement with the state. It's still publicly governed, public oversight over the contract, and through competition and choice, creating competition and choice for nearly 2 million Medicaid beneficiaries.
Granted, the health insurance companies are experienced with medical care, but not so much with mental care. I mean, often these patients need a lot of non-medical care, including learning life skills, help with independent living, and so on. So what experience do the health insurance plans have in managing for those non-medical services?
Yeah, I think we have experience on the commercial side. You know, our members continue to offer mental health benefits on the commercial side. We continue to offer mild to moderate benefits on the Medicaid side today for this population. And the support services, certainly this is a, you know, between the severely mentally ill and the disability groups and the substance use disorder individuals that would be qualifying here, there's certainly a higher level of service and supports that are needed for those individuals. Nobody is disagreeing on that. What we would do and what we've proposed in order to deliver those services is to continue to work with the community mental health authorities throughout the state of Michigan. I want to be clear, our proposals that we've pushed forward would continue to preserve that CMH structure, that local governance structure that exists today.
Some Republican legislators say they want these pilot programs. They want you to manage some pilot programs. They're convinced the state can save Medicaid money. But the question is, how will you make sure people with mental illnesses get the treatment and care that they need, that they've been getting?
I think we would be contractually bound and at full risk. So the biggest thing I've always said is that our industry embraces competition. We have a proud history of that in Michigan with our Medicaid program. It really has driven quality outcomes with this population. We would expect nothing different with the behavioral health population being included as well. We would be expecting that enrollment be driven by outcomes. Those that produce the highest quality would have the members enrolled into it. And ultimately, the individual themselves would have the choice whether or not they wanted to be enrolled in a managed care plan or whether they wanted to maintain under a fee-for-service-based system. And they'd be able to choose between multiple managed care plans throughout various regions of the state.
Help me understand something. Beyond the possibility of saving the state some money, what advantage is there in this integrated service, this coordinated care between mental health providers and doctors that provide physical care?
Yeah, I think it goes much beyond saving the state money. I think the real advantage here is to the individual themselves, and the advantage is in improved health outcomes and an improved quality of life. What we're proposing is really taking the $2.5 billion that exists on the behavioral health silo and the $11 billion that exists in the physical health silo and combining those approaches so that the total dollars, both state, local, federal resources, can be better spent on the individual's needs, reducing and eliminating wait lists for services, and really driving overall both physical improvements and health outcome, behavioral improvements and health outcome, and quality of life improvements for those individuals.
Now, the mental health care advocates say they've held a lot of meetings, kind of town hall events with the patients and their guardians, and they're overwhelmingly in favor of keeping it the way it is right now. You're telling me what you plan, the insurance industry plans, will be better service for them. Why are they so against it? Why haven't you been able to convince patients this is in their interest?
Well, I think it's in our limitations to contact those patients. So we are, our members are prohibited from lobbying and prohibited from contacting our individual enrollees that are members currently enrolled in the Medicaid physical health benefit. So while the PIHPs apparently are not, we are contractually limited in our conversations and communications to those members. So
PHIPs?
The PHIPs apparently can...
No. What does that mean? What are they?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Prepaid inpatient health plans. They're the administrative function that the state currently contracts with.
Right. Okay. That's what I want to get to. Okay. So final question. Your group representing health insurance plans and the Republicans in the legislature want one thing. The mental health advocates and the Department of Health and Human Services want something else. What's next?
Well, our hope is to continue to work with both the Department of Health and Human Services here at the state level and the legislature, both Republicans and Democrats, obviously, to see what we can work with to try to strike a compromise in the fiscal 18 budget. We've been willing and eager to sit down with all stakeholders and really hammer out a compromise that would involve pilots, so that we can demonstrate and really show exactly, as Mr. Fisher noted, that we do have a better mousetrap.
That is Dominic Pallone. He's the executive director of the Michigan Association of Health Plans. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Still to come, we'll hear from the author of August Snow, a new crime novel set in Detroit.
I think August sees Detroit much as I see Detroit, and that is the best frenemy you'll ever have.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. President Donald Trump's proposed budget was leaked last week. In it, it looked like money to protect the Great Lakes would be cut by 97%. That leaked document was wrong. Trump's budget proposal completely zeroed out funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. In addition, there are substantial cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The Michigan Sea Grant is a big part of protecting the Great Lakes. It's a cooperative effort between the University of Michigan and Michigan State. James Diana is the director of the Michigan Sea Grant. Let's start with the kind of work the Michigan Sea Grant actually does.
Our focus is to provide education, outreach, and research to help solve problems of the coastal area of the Great Lakes.
What kind of problems?
Oh, ecological problems, economic problems, even infrastructure kinds of problems. We really deal with how to help coastal communities do better.
So you're talking about helping them figure out how to stop silting in harbors or things like that?
Yes, we have a program right now. We call it our Sustainable Small Harbors Program. And it goes to a local community, a small place, runs a series of charrettes, which are sort of role-playing things with local citizens, comes up with a consensus idea of how a small harbor might be changed to benefit the community, to benefit the economy of the area, to help them figure out how to fund it, and then comes up with a design for how that harbor should be in the end.
Do you also protect habitat, wildlife, things like that?
Absolutely. We're involved a lot in restoration of habitat, of Phragmites control, things like that. We've done research into invasive species, and we've also had a lot of research into just the environment of the Great Lakes.
So tell me, why is that important to Michigan?
Well, Michigan's a Great Lakes state. I think that economically, it's important. About 18% of all jobs and 20% of all payroll comes from the Great Lakes. When we start looking at tourism and recreation, it even gets larger still. You know, being the Great Lakes state, though, I think beyond just the economic value, there's a huge value in the mind, a value of the Great Lakes and their quality matter to citizens of Michigan. And so well beyond, I think, what the economic value is this feeling that the Great Lakes are our lakes and we need to protect them.
So for fiscal year 2016, the Michigan Sea Grant received $1.8 million. What kind of cuts are being proposed in the Trump budget?
100%.
So you would be zeroed out as well as all the other Sea grants across the nation, because there are, what, 33?
Right. There's 33 Sea grant programs. We're funded for about $73 million nationally, and that whole thing would be removed in Trump's budget.
Would you have any funding?
We have funding coming from the state, both for matching people at Michigan State University in Extension and at the University of Michigan for matching the program. So there could be additional funding to remain. It's hard to say what the university or Michigan State University would decide to do with that money if Sea Grant folded.
Well, as you noted, Michigan is the Great Lakes State. How will the state be affected in a practical way without the Sea Grant?
I think that, you know, lots of coastal communities, particularly smaller communities where they may not have the personnel to help plan and do things like deal with how you dredge a harbor, how you build a management plan, an economic plan for harbors, how you deal with dangerous currents and drownings. Those are all things that we put a lot of effort into because there isn't necessarily the people to do that in other areas. And so Michigan Sea Grant would provide that, that would be lost.
What do you make of these cuts? Not just the proposed cuts that directly affect the Michigan Sea Grant, but the killing of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is about $300 million a year, a lot of it spent here in Michigan, and the other environmental cuts that the Trump administration is proposing.
You know, for Michigan Sea Grant itself, I was surprised they got that far down in the budget. I mean, we're about 0.1% of what they need in order to pay off the defense budget that they're hoping to increase. So it seems like pretty far down in the weeds. As far as the overall program, I think that in a way, you know, it's something that has developed recently. It was an Obama administration effort to get the GLRI funded. And it might have just been spite of that sort. It might be
Just a reaction to Obama wanted it, so we don't?
Right. You know, it was actually approved by George Bush, but he never actually funded it. It didn't get funded till Obama was here.
So what do you think Congress will do? How will they react to these specific cuts?
So last week we had a meeting in D.C., and I met with 10 people from our congressional delegation, and all of them were very much in support of Sea Grant, in support of the Great Lakes, in support of EPA.
Republican and Democrat.
Yes, and we've got 9 Republicans and 5 Democrats. So I think that if you look across a Great Lakes state, that's going to make a difference.
You think that's enough clout to do anything?
Well, I don't know for sure. I mean,
eight Great Lakes states. So.
Right. When you put all the states together, and those states largely voted for Trump and were largely Republican, if you look at a balance of power, if they really hold to the idea that they're going to protect the Great Lakes, that's enough to overturn the budget decisions.
James Diana is the director of the Michigan Sea Grant and a professor at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. Thanks for explaining this to us.
You're welcome.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A poet and playwright just saw his first novel published. The crime story is set in today's Detroit by someone who seems to really know the city. Stephen Mack Jones joins us now to talk about his first book, August Snow. For a guy born in Lansing, you seem to have the whole post-bankruptcy, post-Kwame Kilpatrick Detroit spot on, right down to the LED streetlights. So how much time do you spend in the city?
Well, thank you, Lester. Not as much as I used to. I used to work in the city, advertising Young and Rubicam, McCann Erickson. So I was down in Tower 400, then Tower 200 of the Renaissance Center, mm-hmm. when the city was still struggling. But I go down occasionally, and I see all of the tremendous strides that the city has made. There's still a lot that needs to be done, but
yeah, this show has revealed again and again a lot more in the neighborhoods need to be done.
Right.
So let's talk about the character. The book is named after August Snow, August Octavius Snow. What's his backstory?
Well, his backstory is he is a ex-Detroit cop, a former Detroit cop. He was fired from the force because he was investigating the mayor's office. And as a result of that investigation, he was unceremoniously fired. He sues the city, wins a very large settlement, and then goes off to Europe and the Mediterranean pretty much to drink himself to death.
Yeah, it was kind of a round-the-world bar crawl.
Exactly. Yeah. Diving to the bottle of bourbon. So, but he returns. He returns to his Mexican town neighborhood and his Mexican town home, and tries to make a go of it.
Now, his father was African-American, his mother Latina, and as you say, lives in Mexican Town. Why that neighborhood?
Mexican Town is one of the most vital, beautiful, tremendously welcoming neighborhoods I can think of in Detroit. And there are a number of great neighborhoods in Detroit. But whenever I say Mexican Town, whenever I think Mexican Town, I think the warmth of the people, the warmth of the food. It's just a great place, and it has a tremendous history.
Overall, how does your character, August Snow, see Detroit?
I think August sees Detroit much as, as I see Detroit, and that is the best frenemy you'll ever have.
I get that. I understand that. You mentioned he moved into Mexican Town to his parents' house, and he also put some of his money, this settlement money that he got, into rehabbing houses on his block. Why did you decide on that little bit of philanthropy?
Well, August had a wonderful childhood, two loving parents, his father, who was also a Detroit cop, and his mother, Mexican-American, homemaker, painter, loved poetry. So he is the product of two very rich cultures brought together by two very loving parents. So even though he's ambivalent about his relationship with Detroit, he is very clear about his love of his parents, the way he was raised, the cultures that are brought together in him, and his neighborhood.
I have to tell you, some of the details that you put into this really got to me. And one of them, I smiled when you mentioned Cabresto tequila a couple of times.
Yeah,
I recently did a little feature on the Lopez family at their tire shop and talked about their tequila, which they're making in Mexico and importing. It's pretty fine stuff, too. How did you learn about it?
Well, I learned about Cabresto from the Hour magazine article that was done on the Lopez family and Cabresto tequila. And I was, like I'm sure many people were, I was taken aback. I was surprised that one of the country's best tequilas was made by a family in Detroit. That is amazing. So I find this out, and then I'm talking with my brother-in-law, Tim, and he said, oh, yeah, one of his children, daughter. Oh, she likes the finer tequilas. I don't know why she likes that, but she asked me to go out and get something called, Cabresto. And I went nuts. It was like, yeah, that's made in Detroit.
Well, made by a Detroit family.
Yes.
It wouldn't be tequila if it weren't made in Mexico. You know, one of the reviews I read about your book, August Snow, described the writing as, quote, convincing smartass dialogue, end quote. How naturally does that come to you?
Fairly accurate as far as I'm concerned, except for when I'm at home, being a smartass at home can get me in trouble with my lovely wife. But yeah, pretty close.
That same review was pretty critical. It indicated the plot starts to go off the rails. What's your reaction when you get that kind of gut punch review?
You know, it really wasn't too much of a gut punch, primarily because I was satisfied with the story that I told. And I understand that everyone is going to have a different opinion. Publishers Weekly was one. On the other hand, there are the reviews from the Wall Street Journal, the Minneapolis Times Tribune that are exceedingly positive.
One I read says, It's easy to overlook any flaws because of a hugely likable hero who uses his wealth to bring his neighborhood back to life, adding up to a very pleasurable read. So there's that.
Yes.
It's a crime story. What was it about that genre that attracted you?
I have long been a fan of the classic mysteries. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, Chester Himes, Robert B. Parker, especially Parker. I loved Parker, and talk about a gut punch. It was a gut punch to me when he died. Mm. I love mystery. I love thriller. And that's what brought me to August Snow.
If you don't mind, I'd like you to ask you to read a little bit of the book. Give us a little tone for it.
Of course. This little bit takes place at a church downtown Detroit called St. Aloysius. It's a Catholic church. And here he's speaking with one of the Franciscan brothers that runs the church. I told Father Grabowski I'd just returned from visiting my parents' graves. Big Jake, the cemetery groundskeeper, a grizzled black bear of a man, had caught me laying down a bag of cashews, my mom's favorite snack, and pouring out a dram of 21-year-old Auchinshan single malt scotch for my dad on the ground covering his grave. The priest nodded. "They're always in my prayers, August," I said. "For what I just dropped in the collection plate, Padre, I'm thinking maybe they should be in your morning and afternoon prayers, too." "And again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." "Oh, that's pretty good," I said playfully. "You should write that down." Matthew 19:24, Father Grabowski said with a wide, yellow-toothed grin. "Yet another reason why you'll never be on Jeopardy, jackass."
That's great. Thanks. I'm wondering if this nationally, this renewed fascination for Detroit will help you sell some books.
Well,
Detroit's trendy right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. I'm hoping that it does, only because I love the writing process. No one really writes to stuff it away unless you're Franz Kafka. But I love the process. I hope that more people do read it. I'm proud of it. My publisher has been very supportive of me, Soho Press. And as far as Detroit being trendy, I'm really surprised. I'm just baffled. I mean, it's great that it is. You know, the restaurants, the new housing that's going up, even though it's fairly expensive. But yeah, anybody out there outside of Detroit, try the Cabresto tequila. Try Valentine vodka.
I know this is just your first book, but people I saw were already asking, are we going to hear more from August Snow in the future?
August and I have been talking. And yes, yes, you will. There are too many stories that can be told about Detroit, about the people in Detroit, about what's going on in Detroit. And I think August has his opinions. He ain't ready to shut up yet.
I understand you're going around to bookstores talking to people. What's the response been?
The response has been very positive. In fact, I'm genuinely surprised and pleased. People that haven't picked up a book in 3, 4, 5 years because of their busy schedules, they've read it and greatly enjoyed it. People who are aficionados of the mysteries genre, the thriller genre, they love it. It's been really wonderful.
That's Stephen Mack Jones. He is the writer behind the Detroit-based crime story, August Snow. It's out now, available now, and it's a fun read. We'll put any upcoming events on our website to let you know if you want to go see, visit with Stephen Mack Jones to talk about August Snow. That's at michiganradio.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Up next, why some Canadian nurses who work in Michigan hospitals might have trouble doing so for much longer. And in 15 minutes, another edition of our Artisans of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency stopped Canadian nurses who work at Henry Ford. They were denied entry to the U.S. Now, some of these nurses have been commuting across the border into Detroit for years with no issues at all. We have one of them on the phone with us right now. Patty Kunkel is here. What happened?
So, essentially, I have yet to be stopped from crossing. In fact, I am currently at work. But we've been given a notice because my TN visa currently is not due to expire until October of 2018. But as a nurse practitioner, I'm no longer going to be able to hold the TN visa, and I'm going to need to have to move on to getting an H-1B visa to be able to cross and commute back and forth to work.
So how much of a problem is that, getting the H-1B?
I have never been through the process of getting an H-1B yet, so I can tell you getting all my work documents to work in the States has been lengthy in the process previously. Our lawyers here at Henry Ford are going to be helping me to get all the documents that are needed to get to the government and do the processing for us to try and expedite that process. So I can't tell you exactly what that process is going to look like. I just know that I've been requested to give all of my documents already, and the process has started. How long that will take depends on whether or not they allow us to expedite the process or whether I'm going to have to go through the longer process, which, as I understand, can take up to 6 months.
And I understand Henry Ford has about 30 advanced practice nurses that might be in the same position. So that could be a real shortage for them.
There are several areas that practice with only one advanced practice provider working in their area. My particular position is with the cardiac surgery ICU team, and we are the only ones. We have no residents that work on our team. We are the only ones that manage the care of cardiac surgery patients initially post-op and the critically ill. And so we are a very important team for our cardiac surgery patients, and we have been under critical shortage.
This literally sounds like it's a life and death issue. I want to talk to you about some of the headlines I've been seeing. The CBC said Trump immigration policies kill work visas for specialized Canadian nurses. The Free Press headline says Trump visa changes keep Canadian nurses from Metro Detroit hospitals. But the U.S. Customs and Border Protection says they've not had any policy changes. They're just changing the interpretation of the policy as it is at this border crossing. Do you buy that?
I try very little to get involved in the politics. I really don't know what their interpretation was before. I know that I've practiced at Henry Ford in many different roles as a nurse, and then I advanced my practice to nurse practitioner, but I still hold an RN license. So I'm still a registered nurse with an advanced practice role as a nurse practitioner. In my previous role, I was not at the bedside, and every time I hand in a letter to them for submission for a visa, I've never been told by the border that I need to get a different type of visa. I have always been accepted, and I've not been at the bedside my entire career. I am currently at the bedside, though.
It's curious. It's really curious. Well, I wish the best of luck for you as you try to obtain this H-1B.
Yeah, I'm hoping that everything works out well.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Patty Kunkel. She is a nurse at Henry Ford. She lives in Canada, and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents have told her she needs to get a different kind of visa or she can't work in the U.S. any longer. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Your auto insurance is going up. The Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, the MCCA, is adding another $10 to its annual fee, coming in at $170 a year. Joining me to talk about that and auto insurance in Michigan are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader, and Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken, that $170, that's about $14 a month for each vehicle, pays for unlimited care for people who are really badly hurt and their medical bills exceed something like $550,000. Do you think it's worth it?
Lester, we're the only state that has unlimited lifetime coverage for medical expenses through your auto insurance. Now, when you ask, is it worth it? It depends on where you sit. If you're older, wealthier, risk averse, describing myself, it's clearly worth it. You know, and I think about what can go wrong. I look at my 26-year-old son and I say, yeah, it's worth it. But if you're younger, and young people never think anything bad's going to happen to them, or not as wealthy, low income, you're going to question that.
Vicki, a few years ago, I did a series of reports on Michigan's no-fault insurance. Then, and a few times since, the legislature was considering ending no-fault. In addition to all the experts and lobbyists, I met people who had experienced traumatic brain injuries, severe spinal cord injuries. They and their families said without MCCA coverage, they would not have gotten the care and the rehabilitation they needed, and their families would have been bankrupted. So why do so many people want to get rid of this kind of help?
I think it's because it is expensive on our insurance bills. And let's go back to 1972 when the law was originally passed. It was major tort reform. No fault is a model in the country, and more states should adopt it. And it said, okay, if you're in a car accident, instead of having a lawsuit, let's just make sure that everybody's covered, and we created this no fault law. The Catastrophic Claims Association is a reinsurer, and they are very closed. So we don't know when we pay that $160 or $170 on our insurance, what hole it goes into, how it's managed, how it's overseen. Are the expenses really what the Catastrophic Claims Association says they are? And so people are suspicious of the entire insurance, auto insurance law, because of that non-transparent part of it that adds a lot of money to our bills. But if you are in a car accident and you are catastrophically injured, it is so wonderful to have the kind of care that's provided by this insurance. There are no caps on a lifetime. So if you are a 18-month-old infant with a closed head brain injury that's caused by an auto accident, a parent knows that that child is going to be taken care of for life with whatever he or she needs to have as fulfilling a life as possible. And that you cannot put a price on.
To that transparency point you were making, the MCCA was created by the legislature, but it's run by private auto insurance companies. They are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. The courts have ruled that, and they don't tell us how they calculate that fee. And they tell us, even if they did, we wouldn't understand it anyway. Ken, should the MCCA fee that we have to pay for each car, that state-mandated fee, be calculated in secret?
No. The MCCA, which, as Vicki and you have pointed out, is a device to pay for unlimited medical coverage, has to be subject to FOIA, because you have to make sure people understand that what drives your auto insurance cost among the highest in the country are the actual underlying costs. And the only way to ensure that confidence is subject this organization to the Freedom of Information Act.
Finally, Detroit has the highest auto insurance rates in the state, possibly the country. Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan wanted to create the D insurance for city residents. That didn't fly because legislators say, hey, why should Detroit be the only city with lower rates? Now Mayor Duggan wants the whole state to do away with no fault as it stands right now. The problem with that is then we lose that lifetime care through MCCA. We still have to pay for MCCA because there are still those people who are already enrolled and covered by it. but future people wouldn't be able to take advantage of that. So what do you think of this idea of getting rid of no fault and PIP, personal injury protection kind of coverage that we're talking about?
This is why the insurance industry is hiding behind this reinsurance pool that it created, that it operates in the dark. So we don't know what numbers they're using to calculate what their real liabilities are. But forgetting that for a minute, we know that they're sitting on about $20 billion. And if we end the no-fault auto law that the insurance industry wants to pass, they stand, the auto insurers get to split up that $20 billion. It does not go back to the people who paid into that pool that built up all of that money.
Presumably that money would be used to keep up the care that for people who are already covered by it, right? So it wouldn't be just splitting up between the insurance companies.
Correct. But we don't know how they actually calculate how much money their real liability is. The public should understand there's two numbers here. There's the real cash number that's in the bank and that we pay in this year. And then there is this paper number that is calculated by actuaries that determines, based on some kinds of assumptions of lifetime, of the cost of medical care, a host of other caregivers, and they anticipate that number and they multiply it by the number of people that will need that care and create this liability number that they say they have that is underwater. So we don't know if that liability number, which is a paper calculated number, is actually true. But we do know that the auto insurance law has provided families with an underpinning of safety, of economic security, and of health care for auto injury victims that would not be there if we eliminated the personal injury protection. If we allow different scales of protection, you have to be really careful whose car you get into, because if you're in a car where the insurer only has $250,000 of liability, you're in an accident in that car, you only have $250,000 of liability, despite the fact that you may have paid higher insurance rate for unlimited. So this is a very complicated issue. And I understand Mayor Duggan's concern about the auto rates in Detroit. There are other ways to work around that without eliminating personal injury protection. And we should explore some of those. At one point when I was in the legislature, I thought, wouldn't it be great if we paid for personal injury protection at the gas pump, a true user fee? You drive more, you have more risk of being in an accident, you pay more through the pump. That would have been a cost of about 10 to 12 cents a gallon. It would have insured everybody because everybody who drives would pay. People who drive more would pay more. But at the time, the gasoline and diesel rates were approaching $4 a gallon. So it was untenable. But it is a true user fee if you look at it in that aspect. And maybe we should consider paying through the pump. That way we have no uninsured drivers.
Ken, an attorney who specializes in auto law told me that Detroit's rates are so high because of fraudulent medical claims and that doing away with no fault is not really going to cause auto insurance rates to drop that much. So Detroit auto owners will still be paying high rates and not getting as good of coverage. So what's the best route to go?
Well, I can't comment on that, Lester. I mean, Michigan has very high insurance rates. Detroit is unique in that they have the highest rates in the country. And on top of that, half the drivers in Detroit, because of the cost, don't even have insurance, are going without it, even though the law requires it.
Right. And the cost for some of them is $3,000, $4,000 a year.
Right. And they can't afford that. I mean, let's be honest. So, but I think there's sort of a fundamental dynamic going on here. You know, basically, we don't want any reduction in protection or benefits or coverage, but I do want a reduction in my auto insurance premium. And that's the rub. It's a fairly simple equation. In Michigan, the cost, we're hit by kind of a 1-2 punch. We have the only state in the country unlimited lifetime medical benefits, and medical providers don't have any kind of fee schedule, unlike other health insurance like Medicare or Blue Cross, and we have to pay for all of that.
That's Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. We also heard from Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks to both of you. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
Hey, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are people in Michigan who are quietly making pieces of art that have a purpose beyond art. In our series, we're calling them Artisans of Michigan. We're in Detroit this time at a nondescript shop on Mack Avenue.
This is Alex Porby from Insight Design, and we are a fabrication and custom design firm.
Porby works with architects, project managers, working up designs to complement existing architecture or making a design statement.
I'm an artisan, but, you know, you got to put the art in the artisan, right? So, but it's a balance, you know? And what we do is functional. So I'm producing, you know, we're doing lighting, we're doing handrails, we're doing shelving units, bars, you name it. It's just whatever the client can dream up, you know, we can fabricate it.
Why not just do design work? You wouldn't have to get your hands dirty.
Well, what fun is that? You know, you got to get your hands dirty. It's the end product that, you know, I'm always getting my hands dirty first. So when I go to do the design work, I always have to wash my hands or I get smudges all over the presentation drawings, right? But that's where the joy is in it for me. I mean, designing is great and seeing something built, but seeing how you can get your hands into it and produce something using your own hands, there's a lot of pleasure in that.
Some of the work he's designed and got his hands on includes work on top of Jack White's Third Man Record Store in Detroit's Cass Corridor. He installed work at the now-closed Coach Insignia restaurant at the top of GM headquarters Rensen Building. Recently, he designed and built several sconces for the International Banquet Center above Fishbones in Greektown. Porby says his design, his style, varies to the client's needs, but there is a theme.
Obviously, I'm a product of my environment here in Detroit, so I've got somewhat of an industrial aesthetic. And, you know, being in Detroit in the 90s and scavenging through scrap yards and abandoned buildings and stuff you find on the street, and that's inspiration in that as well. And sometimes we would take those components and industrial metal objects and make art out of them. So there was inspiration in that. You just see it all around you.
His shop is full of punches, milling machines, welders, sheet metal benders, cutting torches. It doesn't look like an artist studio. This is a shop. Smoke, sparks, metal shavings, steel pipe and tubing stacked wherever there's room. Other artisans and fabricators share the space with Porby and his team. Unlike a lot of other artisans we've talked to, he's surrounded by people most of the time. But there are those moments when he needs to be left alone with his own thoughts.
The lonesome work. I stick around after work after everyone's gone and do that.
Sometimes designing, sometimes getting his hands dirty. That's Alex Porby with Insight Designs in Detroit, our latest artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who just spent all my money except for $1. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Lee Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Remember, life is too short to drink green beer. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.